So my name is Ben Lignel. I'm currently sitting in my neighbor's living room in Montreuil, France, and having the pleasure to continue an ongoing conversation with art and craft curator and writer Anahiva Rose, who will tell us in a minute where she's calling from. Anahiva, please accept my welcome to this 60-minute recording and my thanks for agreeing to share with the national and international audience some of your thoughts on the writing of craft. This podcast marks the end of a 2-year writing program initiated in Aotearoa, New Zealand by Handshake. It's supported by Creative New Zealand. It will be co-published by Handshake and Critical Craft Forum, which is a Facebook-based conversation hub based in the United States. This first conversation with Anahiva will be followed by another with writer Elle-Louis August, who will speak about her methodology for researching the life and practice of New Zealand jeweler Elena G. So the overall topic of today's conversation is the relationship between the activities of curating and writing for you, Anahiva. In the context of the show Stars Start Falling, which you recently curated at the Govett Brewster Gallery in New Plymouth, and it's open in May and it closed in August, I think, 2021. It focused on the work of Samoan painter Tuani Thibault, which you put in conversation with the contemporary works by Annie O'Neill and Salome Tenguasa. And so I see the podcast as a means to share with the public of craft and arts writers the part that writing plays in a curatorial practice that is engaged with questions of diasporic identities in the Pacific, with historical and mythical time, with implicit and explicit creative genealogies. And as you know, I'm very admirative of the thoughtfulness with which you tended to Thibault's practice. And I see some benefits in sharing with students and peers the unique way you conducted the business of being a professional curator and writer. As I turn to you, Anahiva, to introduce yourself, I also wanted to greet and acknowledge our future audience, the artists, curators, researchers who will find this resource and let it become part of their knowledge base. I thank them for turning to us, and I'm excited for them to hear about your work, Anahiva.
Ko Puketura te maunga, ko o tākou te awa, ko tamatia te whare, ko te rua hiki hiki te hapū, ko naitahu te atiawa me nā te tōrangatira oku iwi, ko Anahiva Rose toku ingoa. Thank you, Ben, for the lovely introduction. I'm really excited to have this conversation to continue, you know, the many conversations I suppose we've had over the course of this project. And hopefully to share with people, I think some of the ways that we've kind of bounced off each other and learned from one another through this. I think you're someone who knows this project really well. And I am always delighted to hear what you think about it.
Thanks for that. Thanks for this nice note. I wanted to make a bit of space for you to maybe start the conversation with the project itself. Stars Start Falling, it was your last project at the Govett Brewster. I think you joined the Handshake writing program around the same time as you started working on the exhibition, and you worked for it for about 18 months until its opening on the 22nd of May. And this project was meaningful to you in many ways. So can you perhaps sketch for our listeners how the project was developed and how you met it?
Stars Start Falling was really a continuation of another exhibition I had made at a space called Enjoy here in Wellington in 2020, the beginning of 2020. And that exhibition put the work of Tuani Thibault in conversation with Salome Tenguasa, Christina Pataila-E and Claudia Jowett. So three women painters of different Pacific backgrounds from, I suppose they're emerging artists. They're in their 20s or early 30s. And again, that project was also anchored by my ongoing interest in Tuani Thibault's practice. And I suppose a desire to think about what her influence could or maybe what her influence is, or maybe what it could be. So I felt that despite Tuani Tebow's really significant place in our Pacific art histories, she was one of the first exhibiting Pacific artists in New Zealand, showing in kind of contemporary art galleries and civic art galleries around New Zealand, and collected by a lot of our major institutions, that she hadn't kind of been closely looked at, or looked at in ways which I thought her practice, at least to me, seemed to encourage. And I was interested in trying to think through what these younger generations of Pacific artists might think of her work and how they respond to it. So Stars Start Falling took This Is a Library, I suppose, as its jumping off point into trying to dive a little deeper into that work. And I think to try and work through, because Enjoy is quite a small artist-run space here in Wellington, to try and approach Tuani's practice, but also Ani and Salome's from the position of a collecting institution that is associated with a district council, and a place that has a kind of complicated history in terms of its engagement with Pacific art. So yeah, I wanted to bring them to New Plymouth, and to see how that city responded to this work.
Can you say a little bit more about the Govett Brewster's history? And I think, at least in the back of my mind, there's Ruth Buchanan's project, which was happening just shortly before that, which really questioned the way that the collection of the institution was built. And certainly your show, or Tuani Tebow's show, resonated with that.
It's interesting. I was actually asked, before developing Stars Start Falling, I had been asked to curate a collection exhibition for the Govett Brewster, and to curate a collection exhibition pretty much straight after Ruth's exhibition, The Scene in Which I Find Myself, or Where Does My Body Belong, seemed to me like a kind of impossible task. She had pulled out, you know, most of the collection. And she had really tried to kind of start to articulate the gaps, I suppose, and make quite clear the voices or the processes that define collection building in an institution like that. So the Govett Brewster is a contemporary art gallery. It collects artworks made from the 1960s onwards, with a focus on New Zealand's contemporary art practices. But interestingly, it has a mandated commitment also to the art of the Pacific. And that was one of the things that Ruth, I suppose, kind of pointed out in her exhibition, and she made that lack quite clear by putting essentially all of the Pacific art, and this is New Zealand Pacific art generally, on display. And there are very few works by New Zealand Pacific artists in the collection. So I suppose instead of actually making a collection show, I tried to make an exhibition that, and kind of following Ruth's lead, again pointed out these absences. So that's where Ani O'Neill came into the exhibition in terms of my thinking, because she is one of the Pacific artists who has most regularly shown at the Govett Brewster. She has quite a strong exhibition history there, but in their collection she's represented by only one work, which is actually a kind of small piece of a larger, quite significant work that's held at Auckland Art Gallery.
So Just I want to pause for a moment to maybe discuss for a moment. Can you tell us, tell listeners, what is the difference between temporary exhibition and collection in terms of commitment, and how bringing Annie O'Neill's work into a temporary exhibition may force or may invite the institution to rethink their investment in her work?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and it's one, it's a kind of idea that I suppose I was grappling with throughout making the show. I think for institutions like the Govert Brewster, you know, collecting institutions around New Zealand, and not all of our major art galleries are collecting institutions. There are ones like City Gallery here in Wellington which don't collect. But I suppose often it feels to me like sometimes our collecting histories and our exhibition histories tell quite different stories, and they talk about what we're willing to make a kind of ongoing financial, often, commitment to. And, you know, it is a commitment to caring for something into perpetuity versus what we are kind of happy to welcome in, but also, you know, welcome out of the building 3 months later. So that idea of kind of, yeah, for a place like the Govert Brewster, which is often, it has shown Pacific art, and usually when it does, it will refer to its mandate to present in Pacific art. But it is a lot shyer about making that commitment. And I think, yeah, one of the things that Ruth's project made quite clear was that, yeah, institutions, they are these kinds of, you know, they are their own machines, but at the same time, they're also driven by quite specific personalities a lot of the time, or very, you know, highly defined procedures that have their own influence on these kinds of decisions.
And let's for a moment speak about her exhibition guide. She's, you know, I love the way that she has been working on language, as you have, I think, but very differently. And one of the things, if I understood correctly, that she did is name sections of the exhibitions through one of the criteria that is sometimes used to describe work, like female or leg, which is in a sort of absurdist strategy to remind the institution of sometimes, you know, the sort of almost tokenistic but also problematic way that things are being categorized. And another thing that she did is to list extensive acquisition histories for the work that was on display. And that for me was an eye-opener because it sort of, it tended to, as you describe, you know, the how things are driven by human beings, and sometimes very fragile connections are being made and explain the presence of something, the gift of someone, or the fact that something was bought in hindsight. And there is something there which is really exciting and gives, you know, readers of that guide some access to the way that these collections are being built. Your work on language is quite different. And I wouldn't say it's absurdist at all. Do you want to say a few words? And we still haven't really described the exhibition, but perhaps you can say a few words about how writing, what is the role of writing at the early stage of your project?
Yeah, I was kind of reflecting on this before our conversation. And I mean, for me, writing is, it's a way of thinking through things. It's a very different process to curation. When I was thinking about this, I was reluctant. I was trying to think about the words, and I was, you know, in some ways I think this is what I didn't want to say, but that curation is quite open-ended. It's highly collaborative, and it feels like it's done, at least to me, in community. Whereas the thing that can be most difficult about writing is finding the space to bring other people's voices in, and to kind of provide a number of perspectives on a single thing. And this is a kind of strategy that we've talked a lot about. But I mean, having said that, you know, I think writing is the place I'm more comfortable in writing, and it is where I feel a lot clearer in the kinds of directions that I might take.
Do you want to speak about the guide now, or should we wait until a bit later?
Yeah, no, we can talk about the guide. I think, yeah, I mean, that idea of writing being a way of working things through is especially true for the exhibition guide for Stars Start Falling. And it's kind of, that's for a few reasons. I think I love the guide for how I can see the conversations that I had with multiple people. So with you and with Al, and also with Tyrone Orhia, who designed it, kind of present in here, as well as the voices of the artists and of writers and thinkers who have kind of guided my practice. And I think it's because of those conversations that it's taken the form that it has, which is quite fragmentary, and which tries to kind of approach the exhibition from a few angles, or through a few lenses. One of my favorite things about the guide is a photograph by a New Zealand photographer, Mark Adams, which he took of Tiwani Tebo, and another New Zealand artist, Toni Formason, at her rest home. And alongside the photograph is Mark's memory of taking it, which is, you know, personal and funny. And yeah, I think a kind of special thing. The photograph is quite old. So yeah, I think it's that multiplicity, that trying to disrupt the idea that there is a single narrative to this exhibition, which we tried to do with the guide.
The guide for me was very compelling as well, and it was surprising and compelling. Surprising because since we've had so many conversations about the exhibition, I knew the depth and breadth of your thinking about Thibaut's practice. I knew you could have written a book, and probably more. And so when I first received the guide, I felt, God, this is such a light version condensed version of what I know Anahiva knows and what she could tell about this. And then I realized as I was sort of, you know, getting into it, how you manage to combine different sort of, as you say, different voices and or different type of registers of language. You know, some of it is about historical context, some of it's about anecdotal evidence. There's a lot about daily and family life, both in the practice of making things. Of course, in the anecdote of how Thibaut started painting, you know, that vision that she had in connection with her daughter. So the personal is present. There's a lot about the conditions of doing work, which I think is coming through, and different ways of interpreting the same work. And so you provide, as you did for me when I was discovering her work, you know, you gave me a history, and you gave me a history, a political history of her move, of where she came from, of the fact that she relocated, of her history with her husband, the fact that she started painting from memory, all of these things. But then you sort of added around this in the guide many other aspects, which I guess allow you know, readers to, well, probably prevents them from one definitive statement and allows them to work through with you some of the things that, you know, some of the ways you can approach the work.
Yeah, and I think because the exhibition guide is, I mean, you know, it was given away free at the exhibition, and it is there were no wall texts, there were no artwork labels.
Hmm.
So it also, I think I was trying to kind of move away from a lot of the descriptive work that some artwork labels do, but at the same time to continue to give people the tools that they might need to interpret the work in their own ways. Mm. And one of the things that felt useful about approaching them kind of thematically was that I hoped that it might show people that they could approach the work from multiple ways, that there wasn't necessarily a kind of definitive and correct way of understanding the works themselves, but also the connections between them, and that in that space. Yeah, I suppose the thing that would be most useful to them was really their own reactions.
Hmm. There's something which I think you described to me almost in political terms when you spoke to me about letting, and I'm quoting you, I think, letting multiple truths hang together, which is, you know, what we're describing, the fact that the guide is open-ended and allows people to construct their version of history. And we'll come back to that idea as well. But can you perhaps say a little bit more about this notion of letting multiple truths hang together? How does that sit with an institution? Why is that part of the practice?
Yeah, it's such a good question. How does it sit with an institution? I mean, I think part of the reason that I think it's important to do that kind of work in an institution is to acknowledge the fact that whether or not institutions kind of tend to acknowledge it, that is the type of work that they also do, you know, that we're kind of cobbling things together a lot of the time, and asking people to place them perhaps in a kind of linear construction of truth, but in the end they all come from disparate sources. They are all they will possibly all be subject to change. These different versions of truth will come back, I suppose, to Pelihofer's text, but he says, you know, different versions of truth may be accepted for particular purposes and moments. And I think that there is an enormous potential in that, and I find that idea exciting. But I also think that it is the way that we encounter truth in these institutions as well. They perhaps just don't tend to acknowledge it that way.
Hmm. So there's two things here. There's the way that some institutions historically have tended to fix meaning or to put you know, work within linear histories, as you say. And then there is a very specific reference that you made, and for the people who don't know it, I want to come back to that, to Tongan anthropologist Pelihofer. And the text that you shared with me, Past to Remember, is a text in which he suggests that the peoples of Oceania should be able to define and construct our past in our own ways. As an alternative, if I understand the text correctly, to the history written by settlers. And that means, again, if I read his text correctly, that means finding this history or constructing this history in the present, despite the lack of tangible sort of documents. And it sort of, I sort of, thanks to you, I think, made the link with Sadia Hartman's notion of critical affabulation, this idea that you may need to invent the past, your own past. Tell me, how his work and those words that he says, how did that influence, the show, the way that you put it together?
Yeah, I mean, I think Past to Remember is a really significant text for me, and it's one that I often come back to. I think, that license to imagine, to redefine and reconstruct our histories in our own ways. And it's interesting, like you say, to kind of, have first encountered that type of thinking in his work, but then to also actually see it in other places as well, like Sadia Hartman. The most important thing, I think, for me in that text is the idea that our most significant source of history is in our oral histories, our oral narratives, which are inscribed on our landscapes. So, you know, there's a few things there, but the idea that the land has its own histories, that it knows its own histories, and that we kind of have to learn them is something that's really important to me. And it's something that comes up in Stars Start Falling. All of the artists in their own ways engage with landscapes, sometimes through memory, sometimes in kind of quite abstract ways. But they're all reaching somewhere, and they've all found a story in a place that they want to try and tell. And it's that sense of connection to place, which I think defines Pacific art, really. And I suppose to me, the most important thing is that, like Kaofa says, we can articulate those connections in our own ways. So sometimes it is through memory, it's through distance, or it's through, you know, things we've only been told and never encountered. And that however we come to these places, our relationship with them is still our own.
You're making a deception here that the audience, the visitors to the museum, will know that and understand that. And as a non-Pacific sort of person, I don't know that I would personally, for sure. Tell me, do you think that is something that you can reliably expect from visitors, that they will understand that a riffing on landscape is a riffing on history?
That's a good question. I don't know that you can expect that. I think somewhere like Taranaki, which has an incredibly fraught history in terms of Māori Pākehā relationships, in which are deeply embedded in that landscape and in the kind of acts of violence that have, you know, not only seen blood shed on the landscape, but seen the landscape kind of divided up in quite violent ways as well. That there are a lot of people, Pacific, non-Pacific, who kind of, if not willing to express that quite so directly, have a kind of feeling, you know, there's something. And I do find Taranaki in particular to be somewhere where that, this kind of, it can be quite a disquieting sense of unease is really strong. So yeah, you know, and that's quite a specific place, maybe people pick up on it. I think in New Zealand generally, it's a feeling that, again, might not be expressed so directly, but is kind of felt. And I think kind of finally for people who haven't thought about those connections before and haven't encountered them in these ways, I think the artwork does the work. I think it can show that without it having to be laid out so explicitly.
I think so as well. And perhaps now would be a good time to think about or to talk about one of the very beautiful installation that you have in the show, where you have I think two paintings by 20 Tebows, which are at the end of a corridor, which is created by two hanging works by Salome Tenubasa. And there's something that's created there, which with very different types of relationship to landscape. Can you describe that a bit better than I do and tell me what your thinking was there?
Yeah, I think the Govett Brewster is a funny exhibition space. And Stars Start Falling covered three galleries in the Govett Brewster, but there are no dividing walls between them. So it kind of, in the end, feels like a very large gallery with a raised mezzanine level in the middle. So you're kind of walking through and up and down these spaces. And what that means is that if you stand in this middle level, which is the one that you just described, you can actually see both ends of the exhibition. You can see through all of the galleries. And so it's a really, feels like a really productive place to make connections between artworks. And that was one of the real pleasures of installing the exhibition and having Ani and Salome there, to kind of think about what relationships we wanted to pull out. And I had a rough idea of where things would go. And there are some things which, because of their size, had to go in particular places. But around that, there was a lot of room to just kind of just shift things around. So in that space with Salome's work, she had six large hanging paintings, and on the walls to either side, on one wall were these works by Tiwani Tebo, which were mostly what are often called her village scenes of life in Samoa. And on the other side was a smaller work by Ani O'Neill called Counterproductive. So it was the only place where all of the artists came together. Yeah.
There's something there in that. So I only know the vista, the view where you can see both of Salome's hanging paintings either side of, you know, what I describe as a corridor, ending with Tuani Tebo's village scenes at the end. And I think for me, what was great about this is that it allowed me to think of maybe three different types of temporality. One of them was the map making of Salome Tenwasa. And I think, if I read correctly in the guide, she has been painting these a short while before the exhibition in a sort of performative process in the backyards of friends' places. And so there's something about being at someone else's place where she's painting these in a sort of gestural, very active way. And to some extent, you could say that these paintings track the moment of their production. And then at the end of that, you have the two village scenes by Tebo, which, and there I'm going back to some of the conversations we had early on, sort of describe both a mythical time, you know, a cyclical time of forever return that is not located in history, but also make reference to history. And so we have like in that sort of, you know, that view, there is conflicting, or at least, you know, different times in friction. And I thought it was an interesting way to, going back to the beginning of the conversation, to think about Tebow's potential influence on younger generations, or how her work is activated by both the similarities and the differences that you find in the younger painter's work.
Salome has a very, she works incredibly quickly. So those six paintings were made over a week, and they're really large. At the time, it was the largest scale that she'd worked at, and that required her to, kind of come up with new ways of actually making them. So some of them were made in her backyard, one was made in her friend's backyard, some of them were made hanging up from the curtain rail in her room. And when Salome makes, she's always responding to the conditions that she's making in. So it's often late at night, once her children are asleep. Or it's kind of, I think when she made these works, it was the school holidays. So she's got them around her and her parents around her as well. I think, the thing that I love about Salome's work is kind of trying to see those presences in them, but it's also being able to see the way that she might make one painting and she starts in one place and kind of moves to another, and you can see maybe a gesture or a colour starting to come through. And in the next painting, she moves on to exploring that more fully. So they do tell, I think to see them all together is a real privilege, because you get to see this kind of passing of time, the changing of places, the differences in the day or the night or whatever it might be. Chuani's paintings, as you say, come from quite a different place, where those works in particular are painted from memories. Some seem to have aspects perhaps of photographs, but it's quite hard to tell. And in the ones that you're describing, I think there's a really interesting, something that I'm quite interested in Tuani's work is the ways that it shows the passing of time, but it also often disrupts our kind of impressions of what the passing of time might look like. But in those works, you can see this move, I think. There's some people in waka, maybe, so in canoes, and then in the next, there's like a motorcycle going down a road. So there's quite, and this is what it was like, I think, to live in Samoa at the turn of the 20th century, was to be a part of an incredible upheaval and these huge shifts in the ways that people lived. And she, it's through her kind of disregard for our conventional understandings of time or time passing or what truth looks like or what history might be, that we can really start to understand what a kind of incredible shift that really was.
And you wanted to challenge perhaps the way that she was perceived. In other words, I think going back to one of our early conversations, you said that you wanted people to see her through the lens of, you know, diasporic Pacific identity, but you didn't want that to be the sole focus. And it seems to me that perhaps those conversations that you've instigated between her and the two younger artists is one of the ways in which you're both allowing a reading which is about her diasporic identity, but also making it more complex, bringing other things to it. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, there's always a challenge, I think, working but to me, it feels very important to acknowledge each of the artists', you know, individual histories. So they do actually, they all come from different places in the Pacific with their own, you know, stories of migration and different ways of coming to New Zealand, and they've built their own lives, and there's only so much use in comparing them in that way, I think. There are ways of looking and ways of kind of being in the world that I think connect them, ways of understanding how we move through the landscape, you know, for example, how we establish relationships with the landscape, how we move through time. It's to maintain that specificity, to say, you know, Aniona was a Cook Islander and Tuani Tebo is a Samoan. And so while there are some connections, and actually Ani's grandmother knew Tuani, you know, there are real connections. They can only take us so far. And I think it's in acknowledging that and then sitting with the difference that we can start to have a really productive conversation. You know, I suppose it's something more like a comparative exercise where we're looking for what connects us, but also what makes us different, and how in that we can start to describe some small corner of the incredible variety of Pacific life in New Zealand.
Mm. In conversations with Annie and Salome, I assume you spoke about, you know, your questions about the influence. that Tuani Tibo's work may have had on their work or may not have had. How did they respond to that? And to the conversation that you put them in?
Yeah, like I said, you know, at the beginning, I had done an exhibition with Salome and Tuani before. And in that exhibition, Salome painted in direct response to Tuani's painting. So we put Tuani's paintings out on the floor, and then Salome laid out her own canvas and made these paintings that were, yeah, very much kind of in response to Tuani's. And this exhibition followed a kind of different model where I knew that she was familiar with Tuani's work. And I kind of just invited her to be in the exhibition and to make work that responded to all of these themes. And I will say, you know, Salome was kind of equally excited to be in an exhibition with Ani as she was Tuani. And they, you know, Ani's influence as well, I don't think can be understated on younger generations of Pacific artists.
Hmm.
So to bring them all together like that was incredibly special. And yeah, for Ani, I don't think she knew that her family had known Tuani until I met with one of Tuani's granddaughters and mentioned that we were doing the show and that Ani was going to be in it as well. And she said, I think that, you know, there's this connection, and they all lived in Auckland. And so that was quite a special thing for us to find out. And Ani had first seen Tuani's work in an exhibition, I think it was Bottled Ocean, which was a major exhibition in the late 90s of contemporary Pacific art, and which traveled around New Zealand. So she was at art school at the time and went down, I think she went down to Whanganui on the bus, which would take quite a long time. I think it would take, I don't know, 6 hours or something. And that was where she first saw Tuani's practice.
Hmm. I wanted to speak a bit more about Annie O'Neill's work, which I discovered through the exhibition you put together. And what's interesting to me is in the guide, you mentioned her use of crochet and the fact that it's connected to a longer history of craft on the Cook Islands. In the guide, you put her practice in relation with the craft and art divide, with question of capitalism and speculation. So I'm sensing, and correct me if you think this is a wrong interpretation, but I'm sensing you're thinking of craft both in terms of heirloom, cultural heirloom, and its connection to community that she comes from, but also as a critical tool. And I have a few questions about this. The first one is when you're thinking about showing craft or craft adjacent practices, what sort of questions do you ask yourself as a curator? Which concepts or histories do you lean on?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question, and especially in relation to Ani's practice. And a lot of Ani's work, in a lot of her work, she draws on different craft practices, different tools, different ways of making that she was taught by her Cook Islands grandmother. And so that includes crochet. It also includes, yeah, quilting, tiwaiwai. And the Cook Islands, I mean, I'm not an expert on Cook Islands craft by any means, but those histories are especially interesting in the Cook Islands because those practices were first introduced by missionary wives who understood that, you know, while the men were kind of doing whatever they were doing, the best place to disseminate information, to gather information, and to essentially, I suppose, kind of share the word of God was actually in these communal women's groups, which were focused around different ways of making. And they introduced, you know, needle and thread to the Cook Islands and kind of taught them about quilting. And these Cook Islands women took that knowledge and made these quilts that are absolutely incredible. Tiwaiwai draw on the kind of natural environments of the Cook Islands. They are incredibly brightly coloured, and they're made in community and often kept in community as well. So only really kind of disseminated as gifts. And so it's from that history that Ani is really working, and she's quite interested in that relationship between Pākehā ways of making this colonial influence and what has turned into very much a Cook Islands, I mean, kind of like an indigenous art form of their own, how they took these tools and told their own stories with them. And it's kind of always been her, part of her practice to bring those skills and ways of making into the art gallery. And that's I suppose, what I was gesturing to with that art-craft divide, is that she really wanted to bring, crochet into the art gallery. And that's why she calls these works paintings, is also to kind of try and upend some of the associations we have about how much things are worth or what their value is, depending on which of these histories they seem to slide into. So both counterproductive and monopoly are landscapes, and they are paintings as well. And I suppose it is those histories that I was trying to lean into in this work. Those, it's so complicated, and I think craft in the Pacific, it's a very complicated thing, and it often feels like the way to approach it is to try and kind of bridge a whole bunch of histories. But I suppose the thing that feels like at the moment is the big tension in New Zealand around the display of Māori and Pacific craft practices is how they're often framed as historical, when in fact they are being practiced now. And so contemporary work is continuing to be made. These practices are continuing to develop. They can sit alongside contemporary art and absolutely hold their own and tell their own stories.
Mm. Thanks for that. I think I have personally no doubt that craft can hold its own. What I think is super interesting, what you just did for me or in the explanation, is that you brought into the conversations histories of making, of cultural influence, an anthropological interest in the way that community happens around a needle and thread, and how that is connected to gender division of labor, but also you could say cultural manipulation or influence by Pākehā people. So suddenly, starting with crochet, we end up with a very fragmentary yet, but already a super rich vision of just how complicated, as you say, the complicated sort of human relation that craft is embedded in or embeds, in itself, which I think is perhaps not the way that you would have spoken about a visual arts practice, because you probably would not have chosen to use a histories of conditions of making as a lead into the practice. And that's the question I was asking. I mean, what are the different tools that you need to use when you think about craft, which you wouldn't have learned in an art history class or an art criticism class? And I think in the course of our conversations, many times you brought into the conversation things that have very little to do with the way things look, and a lot to do with the way they're made or the context in which their making has been transformed by influences and more. And I think I'm asking you this as we draw sort of to the end of our conversations, because I wanted to hear you on what you think are the challenges and opportunities that are specific to speaking about craft.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard. I remember one of our conversations, you know, I suppose one of the things that's interesting about creating this genealogy between three painters and, you know, for however much I believe in these ideas of circularity, and that, yeah, we kind of engage with time in quite complicated ways, I am always aware that in this construction, Tuani Tibo kind of generally sits at what I do tend to describe as the beginning of contemporary Pacific art history in New Zealand. And because of that, it's difficult for me to draw relations for her that move backwards in that conception of time, as I'm able to do for Salome and Ani. And we kind of had some conversations, and they come up a little bit in the guide about me kind of trying to see other Pacific art practices or craft practices in Tuani's work, feeling that there is a kind of influence there because they are part of the way that she would have seen the world and seen things represented from her world. So yeah, this feeling that I have that you can see the kind of the brightness of Te Waiwai, you know, those really solid forms, especially in her flower paintings, there as well. The kind of the really intense detail of things like tapa, which often use, yeah, I suppose, kind of these dotted forms that again come up in her paintings. And I think it's that, for me, the thing that I feel most excited and challenged by in working with craft is, and Pacific craft especially, is trying to push these connections outwards, I suppose, to say, you know, Tuani Tibo, like, could she sit in a history of craft making as well? How does Ani, like, sit in that space? She uses these forms, but she also works in specific ways, and she draws on many other references as well. So, yeah, I suppose that's where the joy is for me.
Mm. Are there types of text authors that you go to when thinking about specifically that problem, how you, to use your expression, how you push these connections outward?
I draw a lot on my background in Pacific studies, you know, and that's right. I've encountered people like Epele Haofa, Albert Wendt, Teresia Te Iawa, who celebrate the kind of incredible variety of Pacific art, and who also kind of aren't art historians, and that's what I find particularly productive about them. You know, they're approaching art because they believe that it can tell us really important things about Pacific cultures. They're not necessarily doing a kind of visual analysis of the work. And so I've always, yeah, kind of enjoyed being able to draw on their work, but also, you know, on art historical kind of ways of looking, and to try and bring them together